The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why are your stories populated with Mormons?
Primarily because my life is populated with Mormons. Or my life was, rather, as a child, more populated with Mormons. And it's a lens through which I can imaginatively examine faith and life questions.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Sean Vestal about God-Forsaken Idaho, a collection of his short stories. The first story in the collection, titled The First Several Hundred Years Following My Death, is one that struck me as simultaneously funny, but also thought-provoking and a little horrifying. Would you read a little bit of that for us, please?
The first several hundred years following my death. The food is excellent. The lines are never long. There's nothing to do with your hands. These are the first things I tell my son. Then we don't talk again for something like 200 years. The food is excellent, but nobody knows where it comes from. Your mother's Sunday dinner, a corn dog from the county fair. You eat from your own life only. You order from memory as best you can. Your birthday cake, your wedding cake, your graduation barbecue. You give the cafeteria workers some coordinate, some connection, and out comes the tray. Your grandmother's pot roast, the double cheeseburger from the Lincoln Inn. If you try to take a bite of someone else's food, it vanishes as your teeth descend. In the cafeteria, the workers call out the year at regular intervals. For a while, every time you go to eat, you hear them shouting, 2534, 2534, until, before you know it, 2535, 2535. Right now, as I tell this, it's 2613. There's a long way to go. Your age at death becomes your age forever. Your body at death is your body forever, from scars to missing limbs to brain damage. In the cafeteria, people sit with others of their age and era. Tables full of bald old men from my century, children from flu epidemics in the 1800s, young soldiers from every time. When you see mixed ages, it's a family, and it usually means someone new has arrived, and they've gathered in welcome. I woke up here at 47, a familiar arthritic throb in my hip. I couldn't think what came before. I beat almost everyone. My mother, my two brothers, my son, my daughter, my ex-wife, possible grandchildren, and Janet, the woman who lived in the apartment down the hall. Not counting my father, I went first out of all the people who mattered in my life. I never went to a single funeral that made me cry. After my ex-wife, Bryn, arrived and spent 50 years or so here, we talked about that, about how I left so much grieving behind. She told me it was just one more example of me getting away with something. She was still angry after all that time. You never wanted to do the things everybody had to do, she said. You're like a child. No one's life is all one way, I said. Or an impulsive monkey, she said. In my whole life, I never felt anything but thwarted and blocked. Nobody ever understands you, not even here. Here is something I wish I'd told my son and never have. There is no peace here. All the trappings of peace, yes, all the silence and emptiness, but those are just shells. If you want peace, you have to find it in the life you left behind.
Well, that's a different view of life after death. Certainly not the pristine picture of heaven presented by most religions. What's the Mormon take on heaven?
The Mormon take on heaven is that basically, if you live a righteous life, you spend eternity with your family. That's maybe the biggest central message, theme, selling point of the church is families are forever. One of the stories in the collection is titled Families Are Forever, and sort of a nod to that. And I think that there was some point when I was younger that I thought that forever could not be such a wonderful sounding thing. You know, I don't remember exactly when it happened, but at some point, the idea of an endless Sunday entered my mind, you know, an endless Sunday where we dressed up and went to church and didn't do any of the things I would have thought as a young person were fun. That just never, and Monday never came. And that sounded not appealing to me, you know, it sounded kind of hellish to me.
One of the characters in the story that you just mentioned, Families Are Forever, sees that a placard on the wall and kind of views it as a threat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I have, like most of us, I think, a complicated family. And there was a point at which every Sunday people would talk about family, though it were just a perfectly unqualified good. Like being with your family all the time was never presented as anything other than an absolute, perfect, positive quality. And I knew in my own life that that wasn't true. And I think that was one of the dissonances that began leading me away from the church.
Reality intrudes.
Yeah. I love my family. I mean, I don't want to overstate that. But
you also dabble with the supernatural, especially in your story titled Opposition to All Things. In that story, a disembodied narrator haunts a young soldier who has just returned home from war. Why did you pair these two men together?
Well, a lot of times, the most honest answer I can give to why I do anything in fiction is I don't know. I will try to answer it better than that. But, you know, honestly, I'm trying to imagine myself into some kind of a situation. I don't start with that situation in mind. Almost never do I start with a story wholly in my mind. But I'm interested in the surreal. I'm interested in the elements of the fantastical in literary fiction. You know, I like Amy Bender and Stephen Milhauser and Kelly Link and, you know, all the fruits of the tree of Kafka, as I like to think of it. So sometimes for me, the fantastic or surreal element puts a kind of pressure on the imaginative situation that allows me to begin to stick things on the outside of it. You know, maybe it's a little germ of dirt in the oyster, perhaps, if I'm lucky. So at some point, the idea of a ghost type of a story with a malevolent ancestor kind of entered my mind. And again, it was a sort of a turning on its head. A lot of times I'm turning certain ideas on their head. In that case, the idea that your ancestry is always this positive force, this positive benevolent force. But at some point when the idea entered my mind that this young man's ancestor might not be such a good friend to him, that was a dynamic that I was interested in. And from there, I felt like I could build the story because I had this sort of underpinning in mind that this was the opposite of something. For me, that's important for a reason I don't really understand, but that it was ancestry as a malign force. You know, the people who've come before us not always leading us in the best directions or to the best places or with the best values. There's also an element of the kind of personal prophecy in Mormonism, not just Mormonism, but to me it's one of the most interesting elements of the faith as a fiction writer because, you know, honestly, I'm more interested in writing about these people who are operating against it in some way, operating against the organizational or systematic body of the church. And the church is based on that. It's based on Joseph Smith's assertion when he was a teenager that he was looking at the world and interpreting the divine in a way that all other people had gotten wrong throughout human history. To me, that's just a fascinating individual act. And there's a lot of that in Mormonism, and there's a contradiction in the sort of following while also considering yourself your own personal prophet to a degree. So I wanted to make these people heretical prophets, I guess. They took it seriously. They believe that they can interpret the world, but they're opposed to the church in some way.
Winter Elders is a story about a man who is stalked by Mormon missionaries. At least that's how the the protagonist, Bradshaw, perceives their visits. And that's one of the stories that was amusing and yet horrifying. I'd like you to read the first couple of pages.
Okay. Winter Elders. They materialized with the first snow. That was how Bradshaw would always remember it. He was standing at the living room window, listening to Cheryl shush the baby, when he saw specks fluttering like ash against a smoky sky, then caught sight of someone on his front step, though he hadn't noticed anyone coming up the walk. He could see about an inch of a man's left side at the window's border, an arm in a dark suit and a boyish hand holding a book bound in black leather. He knew instantly that there was another suit and another leather-bound volume out there, a companion to complete the pair, missionaries. Bradshaw opened the door and blocked the frame. Body language was everything. Announce it. You're not coming in. On the step were two kids in suits, short hair, name tags. One was tall, taller than Bradshaw, maybe 6'4", and the baby fat on his face had begun to jowlify. The shorter one was younger, with avid eyes and scraped cheeks. "Brother Bradshaw?" the tall one asked as he looked into the house. "Hi, we're here from the church." "I can see that." "We're just wanting to check in, to see if there's anything we can do for you." "You could clean out my gutters," Bradshaw said, "or rake the yard." The little one chuckled, but the tall one looked up at the gutters, spilling over with leaves and twigs. The falling snow had thickened. "Don't think we won't," he said. His name tag read Elder Pope. He would not drop his smile or avert his eyes. There was something stubborn in him, and deeper, the sense that he was proud of his stubbornness. Bradshaw was impressed, a little. "After you're done, you could change the oil in my car," Bradshaw said, "so long as you're just wanting to help." Elder Pope nodded softly and pointed with his chin toward the inside of the house. "Maybe we could come in and discuss your list of chores," he said. "Right," Bradshaw said. The littler missionary, his name tag read Elder Warren, said, "Could we just talk to you for a few minutes about Jesus Christ?" "You could not just talk to me for a few minutes about Jesus Christ," Bradshaw said, pushing the door closed slowly against Pope's cheer. "I'd like it if you stopped coming here. Make a note back at the coven."
I don't know. There was something about that story that it was ominous, and yet you know that's what a lot of people are thinking, but especially Bradshaw, because he was a member of the church.
You know, I think I started writing that story, and I hope it's reached beyond this point by now, but I started it in a way that feels now gimmicky. You know, it was just all about the missionaries being unrelenting. And although there are things in this that I do know that some Mormons don't appreciate, my goal was never really to critique, like in this case, these missionaries. And I got more interested in the story when I began to view Bradshaw as sort of consumed with his hatred for the church. I'm more interested in his failures than I am in the missionaries' failures.
Yes, he seemed more consumed by his hatred for the missionaries than they were consumed by trying to give him information about Jesus Christ.
Yeah. For me, that was an important dynamic as I wrote into these stories and revised them, was I wanted to feel absolutely free with regard to the church and with regard to writing wherever I wanted the stories to go. And that included a level of irreverence and acceptance that some people would view it that way. But my interest was not in writing a book that sort of bashed Mormons, or not simply bashed them.
Have you gotten some response, some negative response to it?
Some, yeah. I've gotten some negative response. There are certain people who've reviewed it online that sound to me like angry LDS people. I've had a lot of thoughtful conversations with people in my family and some friends of mine who are LDS, including a friend from high school who just considers this something that I shouldn't be doing. She just considers it, I'm handling something that is sacred to her in a way that I'm not treating it with sort of sacred care. But we've because we're friends, we've sort of talked through it and accommodated it in some way. But I do know that some people haven't liked it. There are some very hostile reviews online that seem kind of based around my supposed lack of understanding of Mormonism.
I didn't find any of those reviews. Well, I want to talk about one review I did find a few minutes, but...
Okay. These are just Amazon customer reviews that I'm referring to.
Ah, okay.
This book sucks, kind of. So reviews is not...
Yeah, I'm referring to reviews written by professional reviewers. You're listening to The Right Question, and if you just tuned in, you can listen to what you missed from our blog, located at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Sean Vestal about his collection of stories, Godforsaken Idaho. We'll be back to talk more about the stories in the book right after a short break. Don't go away. Several of your stories have narrators that many people will find it difficult to like. Specifically, there was one guy in Godforsaken Idaho who watches his landlord die in the driveway. And I wonder about choosing to write with narrators it's difficult to like. Are you doing that on purpose, or do they just come out that way?
Some combination of those. I mean, it's kind of where my aesthetic lies, for better or worse. A lot of the things that I love to read, a lot of my favorite novels and stories, are about unlikable characters. To some degree, I'm also interested in the project of trying to create that empathy that's necessary for a story to work with someone who maybe isn't owed the empathy in the most sort of traditional ways. Of humanizing bad, for lack of a better word, people. I don't know. It's another one of those areas to which the most honest answer that I can give to it is I'm not sure why, but I definitely am drawn in that direction. I could read Lolita 3 times in a row, having read it for years now, and I have to ask myself, what is it about that novel that I find so fascinating? I mean, there's beauty of the language, but the narrator is a despicable human being, an utterly despicable human being. And as I read that novel, I find myself occasionally laughing along with Humbert Humbert. I'm fascinated by that dynamic. I'm fascinated and curious about and kind of endlessly absorbed with what's happening to me. You know, what is that aesthetic experience about? What value does it have for me? And I don't know the answers exactly, but I know that it is a much different response, and it's one I would love to create as an artist, than reading a book in which the main character is likable, or mostly likable, with a few quirky negative qualities, and ends up in a place that is easier for me to approve of. I just find that much less satisfying as an artistic experience. I want to be discomforted in some way, I guess. So it's that aesthetic as a reader that probably is what orients me toward doing that as a writer. I also just feel like I'm part of a cohort that's full of a lot of selfishness and anger and violence and sexism and racism. You know, white dudes in the West that are my age that I've been surrounded with my whole life, there's a lot about us that I am not in love with. There's a lot about our values culturally, to speak really broadly, and that bothers me. And so the judgmental part of me, I think, might want to take that up a little bit.
Back to those reviews, William Boyle published a very favorable review of Godforsaken Idaho for the Los Angeles Times. In it, he writes that you have a, quote, preoccupation with absent fathers, criminal fathers, and regretful fathers. Is he right?
Oh, yes, yeah. You know, there's a very clear reason for it. I had a absent criminal father. My father, and I'm writing about this. It's going to be published in a Kindle single sometime in the next couple of months, I believe. My father was a white-collar criminal, and his crimes kind of came to light and played out over my adolescence. And so I have never sat down and thought, oh, I'm going to write a story that fictionalizes my experience with my father. But almost every story I write has one of those elements in it. There's just always a bad father lurking somewhere in there. And the regretful father is probably my wishful interpretation of my own father. So
your story, titled About As Fast As This Car Will Go, is a little bit autobiographical?
Well, I think I hope that the emotional strength of the story is autobiographical. There are no events that are autobiographical. You know, my father forged checks and, you know, was financially dishonest. He was not a violent criminal. And I didn't ever go into the business with him, so far, anyway. And, but, you know, I'm obviously writing about a young man who wants to connect with his father, and his father is not necessarily worth connecting with. So I wrote that not mindfully, but when I looked at it later, I was somewhat taken aback by the power of that imaginative act, by spending a lot of time and effort writing that story. And I spent a lot of time. I rewrote it and cut things and added things. And I look at it now, and it seems to be so clearly an expression of my hurt youth, you know. But I never thought that when I was writing it.
Well, the reviewer also wrote this, quote, Vestal's characters challenge us to think about corruption and deceit and devotion and redemption in provocative new ways. I thought that was pretty high praise, and it talks about what you just said, or it mentions what you just said, that it's surprising you a little bit as well as the readers. But you didn't sit down with that intention when you started to write the story.
Well, I do want to engage those kinds of questions, those kinds of issues. I want to do something that's authentic and feels emotionally honest and powerful. And I have a kind of devotional idea about writing fiction, which is that it's a way that, whereas some people might do this through religion, it's a way to pay careful attention to life. In a quiet, thoughtful way, you know. So I often want my characters to have that part to their personalities, even if they're kind of disreputable or bad people. You know, I want them to be wrestling with something serious about life. So that part is mindful. The ways that I find to do it is what surprises me. You know, what comes kind of swims up to the surface of my mind. You know, what I find is that I understand the book better having thought about it now that it's come out. When I first started talking about the book, I sometimes felt like I didn't really understand it at all. I mean, that's an overstatement. But people would ask me questions about things that are very clearly in the book, and I would say, oh, I don't really care about that. That wasn't my intention. You know, people would ask me questions about the West, what I think about the West. I would say I don't really think about the West, but it's also like Mormonism. You know, they're just a part of me, so they're a part of what I write.
What's the strangest question anyone's ever asked you at a reading?
Well, people ask me a lot of questions about Mormonism, and they're not necessarily strange, but I think a lot of people who are more angry or sort of opposed to Mormonism than I am come looking for kind of a fellow hater. And I can be that, you know. I mean, I have things. I left the church, and I did it on purpose, and I knew I was doing it, you know, when I was a teenager. And there are things about it that I don't like at all. But that's also true of other religions and organizations. And I sometimes find myself being almost defensive of Mormonism when I'm in those kinds of conversations. And people want to be, because I, as I said, I have all my family is still LDS, almost all. And my brother is a bishop right now. And we all, we're a family, you know, we see each other, we get together. We love each other. And so I don't know how to walk this line exactly between being, you know, my mother would think this book is utterly sacrilegious, you know, but she also, you know, isn't ostracizing me or anything. So we try to sort of work through our differences. And one of the parts of that for me is trying to avoid really overt, easy, cynical hostility toward the church. So I encounter that a lot, and I think people expect more of that from me than they get sometimes.
Yeah, even though you were writing a lot about Mormons, I didn't get the idea that you hated them or any sense that this was a vendetta, you know, any of this book, any part of this book was a vendetta. I just got the idea that you had a lot of things to think about, and it was not black and white for you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because that's how I feel about it. I tried to avoid writing about Mormonism because, you know, for lots of reasons, but I've come to just feel like I don't, you know, it's my heritage. I grew up with this. It's mine as much as it's the faithful Mormon's heritage. And especially as an imaginative artist, what else do I have to use, really, but my own life? And so I don't know. I came to, a while ago, I just decided I'm going to be somewhat relentless and free in terms of where I'll go in my fiction. And at that time, it was easier to choose to do that because nobody was publishing it. but it's been okay. The people that I love and I have sort of worked through it, and I think they understand the spirit I meant it in, too.
And isn't that what writing is all about, to explore something that's in you?
Yeah, it sure is for me.
Sean Vestal lives in Spokane, Washington, where he's a columnist and reporter for the Spokesman Review. There's more information about him at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a week filled with fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.